I'm Miranda Applebaum from Lincoln Center. So happy to see all of you. I'm going to take a slightly different approach, but certainly building on, actually literally building on the amazing work that Moby did, because they did our trainings for us and helped really shape the program. But Katie and I work on a program that is pretty brand new. We did two pilot programs last spring, and we did a full season is in progress right now. I'm saying this with the caveat that we are learning a lot, so I'm less than presenting our must-haves and considerations. I'm sharing some of our biggest takeaways from our first year. So we have a program called Lincoln Center Moments. It is designed as a concert-based experience or performance-based experience, and we also wanted to reflect the diversity of Lincoln Center's programming. Lincoln Center, in case you're not familiar, is the home of 11 resident organizations, including the Met Opera, the New York City Ballet, the New York Philharmonic, the Film Society, among many others. It's a 16-acre campus, and there are 30 theaters, both indoors and outdoors, and we see about 6 million visitors annually to the campus. So people come for a huge range of reasons and have a huge range of experiences at Lincoln Center. The fountain is fairly iconic. So I think that was one challenge that we had when we were designing the program, is people were looking for a lot of different things from us. So we'll talk about that a little bit too. So why were we thinking about this audience for doing programming for people with dementia? I think some of the things that I noticed when I first started working at Lincoln Center were we were getting a lot of, I went around when I first started and met with a lot of different departments within Lincoln Center. And one thing that came up a lot with front of house and security was like, what do we do when someone's wandering? What do we do when someone's lost? So we knew that people with dementia were arriving at Lincoln Center, and we knew that our staff wasn't quite prepared yet to deal with it. We also knew anecdotally and from demographics that we have a very aging population, particularly at the Philharmonic and the Met. And we know from demographics of the city that there's a rising number of people with dementia in New York City. And then we also knew that programs like MoMA and MetEscapes were doing really amazing work in this field. We knew that there was a powerful opportunity for the arts to impact this community, and we really wanted to be a part of that and invite our subscribers back. So we started this program last spring. We did two concerts, both classical, one with the Chamber Music Society and one with the New York Philharmonic. We partnered with Caring Kind to give quite an in-depth three-session, 10-hour training for our security guards. We had about 30 security guards participate, our front-of-house staff, and we were working with our education department with their teaching artists to do training on what to expect from this audience, what to do if someone is lost, sort of emergency procedures, medical procedures, and then general accessibility awareness. We found, luckily, that none of that was needed, and we actually were over-prepared, but it was definitely a good thing. We also spent that time to go around to our resident organizations and say who's interested in working with this population, so that was a great opportunity to learn that the Philharmonic had been wanting to do this for a while and didn't have the resources, were able to provide a platform for them and their artists. So for the pilot program last spring, our main goals were that we knew it needed to be performance-based, that the work of art was primary to the experience. We knew that it needed to be in a physically accessible place. With 30 theaters, it sounds like we have a lot of choice, but in reality, there's programming that's planned out a year in advance. Things cost a lot of money. We are a stagehand house, so there's a lot of rules. So it took us a long time to find the right accessible space, so we ended up doing it in a hall that's on the previous slide. That's a pretty wide open space that we can set up chairs flexibly, so we had to think a lot about wayfinding. And we also knew that while the most people were coming particularly for the concert or the performance, we also wanted an opportunity for reflection. We knew that a lot of things could come up with the experience of being in a room together, particularly for people that feel isolated, and we wanted to have some kind of sharing and community building afterwards. So it wasn't just going to a session and leaving and having a personal experience, we wanted to figure out a way to make that a communal experience. And we also knew that we had a long way to go with our staff training. With the spring season, we learned a lot for those two programs. We learned that we could physically get 75 people into the room in a half hour. That was like really important to learn. We knew that we wanted to share it with more organizations on campus. There's lots of other types of music than classical music, so we wanted to spread that out. We knew from going to creative aging conferences that there's a real need for research, as has been mentioned previously, so we wanted to figure out a way to have a research study as part of that. We also knew that our workshops needed a lot of work. We used our fabulous teaching artists that primarily work K-12, and we found that they had a hard time sort of scaling up for adults, and we didn't give them enough time for training at all for for that. So we knew that we wanted to reach out to some educators that had more experience with that population. And we also knew that we wanted to actually use music in the workshop, so we brought in a partner for that. And we also needed to make a case, I'm sure all of you in culturals feel it's a very tough climate financially right now, so we needed to build ourselves really for success to make sure that we make a case for continuing this going forward. And there's a quote at the bottom that says, my mom is a changed person, she's so alert and awake, unlike previously bored and unstimulated. So we also want to keep in mind the actual human beings in the room, in addition to all of the other things that we have to consider. So this is the season we came up with. If anyone is free on Tuesday, May 30th, next a week from Tuesday, we'd love you to come. So we have space for observers. Juilliard Drama is doing a Shakespeare workshop, so we're experimenting with theater for the first time. It should be a really incredible show. They're incorporating music and scenes. But the season, we also brought in a couple who does the cabaret scene in New York, Eric Comstock and Barbara Fasano, and they did a New York soundtrack, so they played really amazing cabaret style songs, a lot of things that people are singing along to. There's a lot of spontaneous dancing in the room, which is really fun. We also brought in Art Barron, who was actually Duke Ellington's trombonist for many decades. So he came in with his own band and did this incredibly joyful, amazing performance that was so fun. There was a little granddaughter there that was 4 years old that was like jumping up and down the aisles, and the band like second lined with her. Amazing. And then we also continue with the classical music that we know that people love in Lincoln Center. So we want to try a lot of different things. The template that we've been using is a 1 hour performance that includes an introduction to set it in some kind of historical musical context, and then a Q&A opportunity with the artists. One of my favorite Q&A questions was from last year, and someone raised a hand and said, we're subscribers, where are you on stage? If we sit in L101, where are you gonna be? Like, point out where you're gonna be on stage. So it reminded me that a lot of these people deeply, deeply know the work. And then we broke up into workshops. So we do 3 workshops of the 75 people in the room. We give them the opportunity to be in 3 different workshops afterward. The workshops are co-presented with Mount Sinai's music therapy students, which has been an amazing partnership, and our teaching artists who we hired particularly for this project. They're co-presented in a way that, so that we can integrate both visual and performing arts and music therapy techniques to do spontaneous music making during the workshops, which has been a really big learning curve, I think, for us. There's very different approaches from music therapy and art education, so we're having the 2 groups work together has been really interesting to learn from, and I think it's really an important cross-disciplinary approach because people are coming for a lot of different reasons. So we typically start with a discussion of the piece. How do you feel? What did you think? Very open-ended questions about the piece. Then we do a warm-up that's sort of a group sharing warm-up. For example, for the Duke Ellington show, we focused on the song Take the A-Train, and we did a, sort of an introduction name game around the room so people knew each other. Then we talk about whatever the theme is of the event. So again, for the Duke Ellington one, we really talked about New York City and what New York City means to you and where you go on the train, where did you go on the train, what do you know, what do you love about New York City? So that opened up some really great conversation around that. Then we typically do a music making, so that could be singing, that could be writing lyrics to a song together through poetry, and then performing together. And then there's typically an art making expression component of it too, and then a share. So we pack a lot in an hour. So big lessons learned that I'm going to do really quickly. The first one is there's no way we could have done this on our own. We did not, Katie and I are a department of 1.5 people. There's no way we could have pulled this off. So we knew that we needed to bring in a lot of help. So as I mentioned, Mount Sinai, the Louis Armstrong Center for Music and Medicine has been an incredible partner. They also designed a research study for us that they're conducting both on our staff to see if the attitude toward dementia has shifted. And then they're doing an understanding of what the impact of the program is both for the person with dementia and the caregiver. And then Karen Kine was an integral partner for us too. They're our training and outreach support. They did training for our staff. They've observed all of our programs and giving consistent feedback. They are also sharing that with their network here, so that has been a huge, 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 those 2 things were things that we could not have accomplished on our own. We learned that in some ways we're like museums, in some ways we're not. My education and training has all been museum focused, so I thought in some ways I knew a lot about working with this audience, but in a lot of ways it's very, very different in a performing arts setting. I think one of the biggest challenges that we tried to figure out was how If music is a sort of an ephemeral experience, so you can't sort of rewind and go back to where that was, how do we talk about that without having to rely on people's memory? So if you're unable to recall what happened an hour before, how do you have a conversation with it? And how can the educator make sure that it's a supportive environment to talk about that, that people don't feel that pressure? I think what we found was that music sort of taps into a deeper part of the brain that I cannot explain well, but that there people, even if they can't recall what had happened, a lot of people deeply feel uplifted after the experience, and that's what we try to focus on. We learned that the audience is very diverse and they want very different things. So these are three different quotes, and just to summarize the quotes very quickly, these all came from either surveys or focus groups. The first one came from a focus group that Caring Kind led that was really incredibly helpful for us. He's describing a workshop that he attended at Lincoln Center, and this one broke my heart a little bit to hear, but you know, you have to work through it. They had a program for people who were really very totally out of it, and I found it depressing. So he expressed that he was in a room of people that were more progressed than him, and he doesn't want to think about where he's going, and he did not want to be in that room. The second one is, the way it's set up now, much of what happens seems over the heads of the group. Your educator should know how this may be done better. So those are two very different things, right? And then the last one is, this is a superb program. And then what's not good about it? So these are the people that are coming, right? So we need to figure out, so we try to update the intake forms to learn a little bit more about people's prior experience and their interests. Some of the rights early stage looks really different in different people on different days, so that isn't a perfect system either. So I think what we're learning is we're learning from the people that are coming, and it each time gets a little bit easier. Music therapy versus therapeutic techniques. I've had some really interesting conversations with people in the room around bringing in music therapy and whether an art experience should be therapeutic or have therapy methods within it. This is a conversation that's ongoing for us. I'm not sure where this partnership will go. I think we've learned a tremendous amount from spontaneous music making. There's some photos in the room of people engaging with music. Some really special things have happened in the room as far as expression and dance. That does not look like therapy to me. And then there's other moments that feel more like a therapy session. So I think these are things that we're balancing within our program. Is that the last one? Oh, no, sorry, I skipped one. And lastly, which I said a little bit earlier, is it's an audience that really tells you like it is, you know? And I think even more so than some of our other programs for people with disabilities, they really expect a lot from an institution they've given a lot to, right? They've spent a lot of time at Lincoln Center, they've invested in the arts. We had someone in our focus group who was on the board of the Brooklyn Philharmonic. These are not people who want to, you know, be told how to find the beat using a baton, you know? These are people who really, really have a deep and rich history with music. So we needed to figure out a way to keep the level of our program so high and the quality so incredibly high, but figure out inroads for people depending on where they are. And that's a piece that we're still certainly learning. And then the last part of this, which has come up multiple times, is why do the workshop? Why do art? There's museums that do art really, really well. What you guys do well is music, just do music. And that's something that I struggle with because I wonder, you know, I do think it's important to have that opportunity of community building and reflection together, and I don't know how to do that in a way that's not a workshop, so I'm very open to other ideas. So I think the way that we've thought about it is that you have the opportunity to opt out of the workshop portion if you don't want to, and it's not going to be for everyone. I think that's similar to MoMA's approach with art making. So what's happening next? We have one more program left. We're going to do a pretty deep debrief with our teaching artists and our partners to figure out what to do for year three. We have a focus group with Caring Kind in a couple of weeks to understand the group of people has gone through at least three of the six programs, so they're going to give us really in-depth feedback on their experiences. Our research results should be available this summer, and we want to make those very widely available. And we're planning now for the season, and I think in the nature of nonprofit budgets, we should know on July 1 if we're able to do programs in September. So we'll see. Fingers crossed. Cool. Thank you so much.